Let's get this party started.
Welcome to the I Squint Podcast.
Welcome, everybody, to this, the third episode of the I Squint Podcast with your host, Justin Lang. You probably already know what this episode's about. Back at LDI, I got a chance to sit down with Brian Dowd and Joe Cabrera from Act Lighting to talk a little bit about the Grand Mach 2. Now, if you follow Cat West and Joe Cabrera's website, consolecocktails.com, you've already seen a preview of the interview that we did at LDI. So rather than just keep rambling on, I'm going to just jump right into the interview that I did with Brian Dowd and Joe Cabrera from Act Lighting. Here you go.
All right, so we're here with Brian Dowd, VP of Sales for Act Lighting, Joe Cabrera, Director of Software Support and Development for Act. We're going to go over a little bit about the Grand Mach 2 and the difference between Grand Mach 1 and Grand Mach 2, the hardware, and specifically the Series 1 and Series 2 software. Guys, thanks for joining us here on the iSquint.net podcast.
Hello. Good to be here.
Thanks. So, Joe, let's start off with the hardware. What specifically is the difference between Series 1 and Series 2 hardware, besides the Battleship Gray going to black? I know that's a big thing that I like here. So,
well, the broad answer to that question is over the past 10-odd years that we've been selling and supporting the Grand Mach 1 hardware and software, we've learned a lot of lessons from things that are not as good for a touring type of console, like, say, for instance, a hard drive with a platter in it, for one thing, to things that could be a little more, let's say, user-proof, to be nice. So all of the lessons that we've learned over the years, we've tried to actually incorporate what we've learned into the new hardware. So starting very simply, for instance, we could look at the faders that we have. Just looking at them, touching them, they feel like the same type of fader caps that we had. But at this point, they're actually touch sensitive in the Series 2 mode. One of the things that leads to, or that gives you, in the Series 1 hardware, if you had, say, a whole bunch of subwoofers front of house, you could have an excessive amount of vibration. And that vibration could push one of your faders up off of zero, which could trigger one of your cues if you had it set to do so. So you could have cues firing in the middle of the show that you didn't actually mean to have firing. So at this point, the fader being touch sensitive, it actually realizes the difference between vibration in the room and your finger actually moving the fader.
So you're saying if there's a lot of bass and the faders are accidentally moved from vibration, there's nothing triggered from that slide?
Exactly, because it realizes it's not you moving the fader.
Wow. Impressive.
There you go.
So what other key differences are there between the two platforms?
Actually, staying just on the faders, if we could.
Sure.
One of the things we had with the Series 1 faders, as the metal bit goes down into the case of the console, that led directly into the mechanics of the fader. So if you were in an environment where you had lots of debris in the air, something like that, a construction site, or just someone eating a sandwich over your console, that could lead to support problems pretty quickly. Here, the fader mechanism is actually a side-mounted fader. So the metal drops into the case and then slips under the sides so that if any debris falls in, it completely bypasses the mechanics of the fader itself. On top of that, the first PCB that you would hit has nothing printed on the top side of it. So even a small splash of water in there is not immediately going to contact anything electrical. Of course, if you dump a beer into your console, you're eventually going to run into problems, but we're trying to mitigate that as much as possible.
You waste a really good beer at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's called alcohol abuse. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's never a good thing.
No.
So you've made this thing almost user-proof. Nah, I won't say user-proof, but
you've tried.
You've really gone inside and moved things around so it can be brought out on tour and not have to be cleaned as often or have to be worried about, right?
Well, you still want to take a good amount of care of your console, but we like to think it's going to stand up to a little more abuse
exactly.
than what you had before. I mentioned before a platter-driven hard drive being something that's, again, dealing with vibration as you might have with subwoofers front of house or located somewhere very near the console in your installation. All of the hard drives within the console in the Series 2 line are all solid state, so no moving parts, completely not susceptible to any sort of vibration or shock damage or anything like that. So,
what size hard drive are we looking at?
I think we're looking at a 32 gig.
And roughly show file size?
Minuscule.
Minuscule compared to that.
Yeah. The one of the upgrades that we've seen from, since you asked about show file, if you had used the Series 1 consoles with the Series 1 version of Grandame 3D, there was kind of a separation between what was stored in the console show file and the environment that was actually built into the 3D show file. So you had two separate show files that you could walk around with, one representing your venue and the other representing all of the programming that you'd done. At this point in Series 2, we've actually merged those two things into a single show file. So not only does the console understand everything that's patched and everything that you've queued into it, everything that you would expect a show file to contain, it also understands the entire 3D environment as it exists in Grandma 3D.
Wow. Impressive.
Handy.
So what other key aspects here are we looking at between 1 and 2, just in the hardware?
Just in the hardware, for instance, if you look at the monitor wing that we had before, everyone at this point kind of laments the loss of the big yellow push to erect button on the console. That was a gas charged shock before that actually had a hydraulic actuator switch to it, mm-hmm. Much like you would find on an airplane seat.
Okay.
Hold in the button, you can move the thing. When you let go of the button, it's pretty structural wherever you've left it. The problem that we've seen to that, again, for roadworthiness, especially if people had custom made their own case for the console, mm-hmm. we might find times where they hadn't cut out a little piece to allow that button to stay up. So they would be putting pressure on the button while it was vibrating in the back of the truck, and this could eventually lead to a leak of the hydraulic fluid inside the console.
Wow.
Which presents a couple of different problems, not the least of which that you can't actually raise the monitor wing if you can't push the button in.
Okay.
So at this point, we don't have the same hydraulic actuator switch. In fact, the monitor wing is now motorized. Ooh. So holding down just a couple of buttons on the screen allows you to adjust the screen up and down. Difference there being that we're not given to any sort of leaks. If there is a problem wherein the motor stops working, mm-hmm. you can still raise and lower the monitor wing itself.
Okay.
And you're not stuck in a position where you can't see your screens. This is one of those points where I can give you an idea of how far they go into over-engineering this kind of thing. This mechanical motor in there means that we have places where gears mesh inside of the case of the console.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine if a gear were to mesh and someone were to force it, there is a slight possibility that you might shear off a little piece of metal.
Mm-hmm.
And that little piece of metal is the last thing that you want to have floating around inside the case of a console to get in touch with the motherboard or some other piece of the electronics. So if you were to look inside the case of the console, directly underneath where those gears mesh, welded to the bottom plate of the console case, you'll find a magnet.
That collects all that.
Exactly. So if anything should come off, it's going to get stuck to the magnet and not cause you any problems.
Those Germans did a lot of thinking behind this.
There is a
they?
Lot of thinking, yes.
Wow.
One of the things that you might notice immediately looking at the console is the buttons. Instead of having a silk screening on the console, we actually have a laser-etched LED backlit button. Every button on the console is made this way. So for the most part, I personally don't even tend to use the desk lights on the console anymore because I don't need to light up the keys because they light up all of them by themselves.
Exactly. Great.
Very handy.
Now, one thing I did notice when I saw the board earlier was there's no enter key.
That is true. The syntax, though, remains very much the same. Everything that you were used to doing on the Series 1 within the syntax, you can still do with the addition of a whole lot more that you're able to do. But you're right. The enter key is gone. There is a key still in its place, and that key now says please.
Okay. Why please?
Because we wanted this to be a very polite console.
So let's go back to the hardware real quick, and then we'll jump back into Series 2 software. Explain a little bit about the layout here, some of the additions, some of the subtractions from 1 to 2.
In terms of just looking at the executor controls, any of the playbacks that you had, on the Series 1 full size, you'd be used to 20 of what we called executor faders, so playbacks you could think of them, and then a bank of 40 executor buttons where you could augment all of that with whatever you like as long as it doesn't specifically require a fader. On the Series 2 full size, you're looking at now 30 faders instead of 20, and 50 executor buttons instead of 40. So some of them have shuffled around a little bit. Where you used to have the 40 executor buttons, you now only have 20, but the other 30 actually line up under all of the executor fader buttons. So that it kind of allows you to be a little bit more ambidextrous in your playback.
Okay.
In the place of where we had those extra executor buttons in Series 1, you'll actually find a screen showing up there. In fact, this is a multi-touch screen on the console. So this allows us to do some very interesting things. At this point, we've got some views built in there for controlling colors and also for playing around with framing shutters within fixtures. But we have a very long list of a lot of things that we're going to be able to do with a multi-touch screen.
Fantastic. Well, let's just jump into the difference here between the Software 1 and Software 2. Let's start off with the basics. What can we expect to be new from Software 2 to Software 1?
One of the things that we like to stress is that a lot of the things that you'd be expecting to see, a lot of the things that people have grown up understanding that this is what a grandma is supposed to be, those things are going to remain the same. As I mentioned, the syntax starts out being exactly the same, but there are additions to it. The views that you create start off from exactly the same position, where you have a blank screen, looks like a grid, and then you can place any types of windows that you'd like onto this grid. And a lot of the color schemes remain the same in terms of selected fixtures showing up the same within a fixture sheet, active values, things that you've adjusted and changed. Those all show up with the exact same color schemes as you're used to. So although the displays themselves look a bit darker, it's kind of a primarily black background as opposed to the light gray that we had in the Series 1, again, going from gray to black.
So there was really no significant reason other than keeping the console black, keep the screens black. There's no benefit in a dark
well, in,
booth? Or
well, in certain environments, not necessarily a booth, but if you're in a place in the house, maybe your front of house position actually has audience members behind you,
mm-hmm.
It's nice to be able to sort of mitigate the light pollution that your lighting console actually creates. So whereas before, you know, you had a certain amount of adjustability in the screen brightness itself, it was still a pretty primarily bright screen coming off of the Series 1. But in Series 2, as you notice, the displays are mostly black, but then again, you have the ability to brighten up or darken your screens as you like.
Excellent. What else? What else we got here?
Well, as I mentioned, kind of take everything that you know about a Grandma 1 and multiply it, sometimes by 4, sometimes by 10.
Specifics, what are we talking about?
Well, for instance, if you were to look at something like a groups pool or any of your preset pools, in the Series 1 you're used to being able to store about 1,000 of each of those. Now you're looking at being able to store about 10,000 of each of those.
I need more.
Okay.
Can I have more?
Yes, actually you can. One of the things that the Granime 1 series of consoles does very well in terms of software is its multi-user support, whereby we may have multiple consoles controlling different aspects of the same show file.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, maybe one person is controlling video, another person is controlling moving lights, somebody else might have conventionals and LEDs. So maybe me as the moving light programmer, I don't want to have to think about all of the rest of those things. So there are ways in the Series 1 to be able to very easily kind of section off the patch of the console with something that we call worlds, so that I only have to deal with and see in my screens all of the things that I'm actually concerned with. And that extends to the point where if I were to delete a queue that had information from everybody's patch, I would only be allowed to delete what was in my world.
Oh, okay.
In the Series 1, if you looked at your executors, everyone had the same executors. So if I put something on page 1, you would see it. If I move the fader, you would see it. Group 1 was Group 1 was Group 1, no matter where you went.
Across the whole show.
Across the whole show. So the only thing that was really something that you could break up was essentially the programmer of the console. Everyone else still shared all the rest of the data. In Series 2, we're introducing kind of the next step of that multi-user programming, allowing that to extend to multi-user programming and playback as well. So now, at this point, I'm logged in as a particular user, and I can store 10,000 groups. If I were to log in as a different user, I would have the ability of creating 10,000 of my own groups.
And how many users are we limited to?
At this point, I think you're allowed to have something like 200 on the network.
Wow. Okay.
So the nice part about that is that this is all built into the command line syntax of the console. So whereas before I would select group 1, mm-hmm. if I were to select group 2.1, then that would be group 1 out of somebody else's groups pool. So we still have the ability for us to work in concert with each other. Maybe if you've created a bunch of color presets that I'd like to use, I wouldn't have to switch to your user. I can just pick and choose things that I want to grab.
Impressive. I like that. So let's look at specifics going back again to hardware. What kind of universe count are we looking at out of the console?
Well,
where can we go with it?
One of the things that I like to clarify to people is the separation that we see at MA between what is a parameter, which is what we consider our limitations to be, what is a DMX channel, and how those are different from each other, and then how that interacts with the universe count that you can use on the console. So for us, for instance, to say pan, we would consider that to be one parameter.
Mm-hmm. Even though there's a fine and
on most fixtures, course. Yes, there would be two DMX channels that would actually work together to create that 65,000, however many steps you'd like. So that would be one parameter that takes up two DMX channels. In Series 2, we actually can calculate parameters down to 24-bit, so that would be three DMX channels.
Oh, geez.
Not a lot of fixtures using that at this point, but we like to be ready for those who'd like to.
Oh, wow.
So our limitations in terms of calculation are based on the number of parameters, regardless of whether those parameters need one, two, or three DMX channels. So the full-size Grand MA2, mm-hmm. straight out of the box with no extra hardware added to it, will calculate internally 8,192 parameters.
So 16 universes worth.
Of 8-bit parameters.
Of 8-bit.
Right.
But if we're talking 16, then it's half of that.
No, it's twice that.
Okay, I'm going the wrong way.
Yeah.
It's wishful thinking.
Yes. So, and if you need more calculation than that, you have NPUs, the network processing unit. Each one of those adds another 4,096 parameters.
Parameters. Okay.
So, where we see a difference between the number of DMX channels or parameters and the number of universes that you can output is we say you can patch to any one of 256 universes that you'd like, regardless of how many parameters you're using. So, for instance, we could patch a show that had 256 8-bit dimmers in it.
Okay.
And we could patch one into every one of 256 universes. So in terms of the 5-pin XLR DMX cables that you're going to need to be able to output this, you could consider that a 256 universe show, even though you're only using 256 parameters worth of calculation, so you're well within the 8,000 that you're able to do within one console system. What this does for you is it allows you a lot of flexibility in how you patch and cable your show. So you can say, maybe I have 10 lights that are on this particular piece of truss, patch them in one universe, and that keep things, you know, very separate in my mind, in the ME's mind, so we can think if there's a problem here that's with universe 3. If it's only maybe 100 or 300 channels or something like that that are being used within the universe, you don't feel like you're wasting the rest of those DMX channels because you can simply patch those parameters somewhere else.
Okay, great. Am I missing anything?
Software. As we've mentioned, take everything that you know, build on that same syntax, that same philosophy, and just add to it. There was a little bit of a separation in Series 1 between what you could do in the command line and what you couldn't do in the command line. So, for instance, when you got to the point of setting up your network, changing your IP address, inviting stations into your session, telling the console to save the show, these are things that you couldn't do directly within the syntax. You would have to go into a menu somewhere and actually touch buttons on the screen.
Okay.
We've taken that line away in the Series 2. Everything that you can do on the console, you can do within the command line syntax, which also means, as an extension from what you can do in Series 1, that you can automate all of this stuff from macros.
Oh, wow.
So, for instance, I could write a macro that would tell my console to save its show.
Okay.
Or tell another console on the network to save its show. As an extreme and probably not very usable example, I could write a macro in the console that would write a fixture profile from scratch. Not necessarily something that you would do, but...
But it has the capability.
Exactly. That gives you the idea of where you can go with it. In fact, we've taken the macro language and we've extended it to places where people are not actually sending their consoles at this point. The macro language is now a scripting language, whereby you have user-defined variables that you can use, you have if-then statements that you can run, you can halt the macro in the middle and wait for user input.
Oh,
so
wow.
If you're looking for a specific color preset number that you're looking for, you can wait for the user to enter that number and then continue on with the rest of the command line of the macro. On top of that, and for permanent installations where you do a lot of show control from different sources, the entire macro language of the console can be accessed remotely via telnet. So you could be anywhere in the world and logged into the console, edit any cues that you'd like, upload another show, correct
wow.
anything that's going on in the network.
So you can do anything and everything from anywhere, basically.
Pretty much. That's where we're headed.
So what other cool things are we missing here? What is really impressive? What's new that just blows your mind away from Series 1 to Series 2, hardware, software?
Well, some of the things that they've added into the software, I honestly don't have one favorite thing that I've seen.
But what's impressive?
There are a lot of impressive things. One of the things that was extremely powerful in Series 1 that we've gone and amped up again were the bitmap effects. So where in Series 1 you could create a two-dimensional layout of any type of fixture, whether they were conventionals, LEDs, which were probably the ones that were used the most, but on up into moving lights and any controllable parameter that you have there. So with this layout, you could say, I have this many rows, this many columns of fixtures. Here are the fixtures in each of those spaces. And once you've done that in the console, it could see that layout as a display, and each fixture as a pixel within the display. So then you could lay on a bitmap, and then you could animate that bitmap, whether you were spinning it or scrolling it. You could type in text and have it scroll by. And this could control any part of the fixture, whether it be the dimmer, whether it be color mix to a full-color bitmap,
mm-hmm.
or even you could have it trigger presets. So imagine the white level would trigger maybe the iris open on a particular fixture, and then the black level would be iris closed.
Wow.
So now as this text is scrolling by, you're actually having irises popping open and closed to spell out the text for you.
Impressive.
So with Series 2, like I said, we've amped it up. So instead of just being able to create a two-dimensional layout, the bitmap effects are actually based within our stage view, which is a three-dimensional representation of where the fixtures are. So essentially you can point the camera from any position that you like within the 3D space
mm-hmm.
at any of the fixtures that you're looking to drop this bitmap onto. And then the bitmap engine works as if that camera were a projector for this bitmap. So then whichever fixtures you've told it it's going to drop onto, it'll drop onto with the perspective as if it were shooting out of that camera.
So what other neat little things with Series 2 software can we see here?
Just a couple of basic things to mention. Effects based off of presets, which was something that you couldn't do in Series 1. So it takes a lot of the math out of effects, literally just being able to say, I want to go from blue to white and not have to worry about what that actually means number-wise. You can do timing within presets. So if there's a particular type of delay timing that you're using across fixtures and things like that, you can now store that and call it from presets.
So, Brian, let me ask you a question. Where can we see, we obviously know this is a touring board, but what other markets can we see the Grand MA2 series consoles go into?
The Grandma platform is just a great console. People tend to think of it as a moving light console or as a touring console. It's just a great console. Right now, it's currently running live television shows.
Who specifically?
George Lopez Show is running not only Grandma 2, but running live with Grandma 2 software, version 2 software.
Which is not released yet, correct?
It is released in baby steps, but it's there. We can get to that in a second, but to keep on the question that you asked. CNN is running Grandma 2's. The CBC is running Grandma 2's. Shrek, Broadway show. Very common in Broadway is you'll have, say, a grandma running the moving lights and another console running the conventionals. Shrek is completely grandma all the way around. Conventionals, moving lights, media, everything, grandmas. So there's markets all over the place. The Boston Symphony is about to go live with, in the first week in December, on a Grandma 2 with the Grandma VPU media server. So it's not strictly touring. Now, that said, in 2008, the top 10 grossing touring acts per Billboard were all Grandma tours. So yes, you know, the U2 360 tour is driven by grandmas. So that is a dominant marketplace for it. But it is, you know, it's in Disney, it's in theater, it's in television, it's in special event markets.
It's out
there all over the place. And on a global level. That's the thing too. It's everywhere all across the globe.
Well, you mentioned something you want to come back to Series 2. When can we expect the Series 2 software to finally be released?
Series 2 software, like all Grandma, the whole MA product is an organic process. There sort of isn't a beginning and an end. The most important thing is that Series 2 software performs everything exactly that you would have a Series 1 do. At that point, then the fun begins. It is very close to that point. Right now, it's version 1.5 on Series 2 software. Version 1 was only released in May, so we're really looking at a very short window. I can't tell you when 2.0, which is the point where the fun begins, is going to be released, but we're getting very, very, very close.
But people are currently running a version of Series 2 that is not complete?
That is correct. It's version 1.5, which is what you're seeing here right now, which is what's on, you know, out there, and anybody with a Grandma 2 is perfectly capable of using, is out there. There are shows running with it. There are tours about to launch that will run with it. As I said, the George Lopez show runs with it. There are other projects that we can't really talk about that are being programmed with it at this point. So it's, again, it's very, very, very close. But the most important thing is that it is completely stable and does everything that a Series 1 does. Also, that said, every Grandma 2, since we started selling them in March, runs in Grandma Series 1 compatibility mode and is a rock-solid Series 1. And there's been many major tours this whole summer that all ran in that mode, such as Beyonce, Yanni, several others.
So running Grandma 2 hardware under Series 1 software?
It's Series 1 compatibility mode. It takes the Grandma 2 and turns it into a Series 1. Okay. So there are some features from a hardware standpoint as well as software standpoint on a Grandma 2 that then no longer are accessible because it becomes a Series 1. You're sort of turning the clock back. But what it does is it enables you to use the console in either form.
Okay, great.
As far as where it's going and what's going on, there are currently about 600 Grandma 2s out there in the world today.
Already?
Correct, already.
Wow.
So it's the momentum is significant. And like I said, from version 1 of Series 2 software in May to now is really a very small span of time.
So we're sitting here with the Grandma 2 full size. What other versions of this console are there available?
From the time the product was launched at ProLight and Sound, the entire product range was launched. It wasn't, here's the full size, and we'll get to all the other stuff. So what you have is the full size console, which, as Joe stated, natively on its own, is a 16 universe console. You have the light, which is 8 universes, and the ultralight, which is also 8 universes. The ultralight, the light, and the full size share the same form factor. The ultralight and the light are slightly smaller, but they're identical in size. What they've done is this way, all the executor keys, the programming keys, everything stays in the exact same place for every console. So there's no sort of relearning where things are as they shift around. There's also the replay unit, which is basically a console without the physical front end to it. And there's the VPU media server and the NPU, which is the processor, the replacement for the NSP.
Well, I would like to thank both of you guys for joining us here on the podcast. Brian Dowd, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy time here at the LDI to join us. Joe, sorry we had to take one of your training sessions away from you, but thank you so much for being here with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us do this.
So there it is, the interview with Joe Cabrera and Brian Dowd from Act Lighting about the Grandma 2. Hope you guys enjoyed it. As today is December 31st, 2009, the last day of the year, I want to wish you a happy, bright, and safe new year, and thank you for reading iSquint.net.
A very happy new year.